What's up, Dune fans? Welcome back to the Do Not Enter podcast, where today, the Fremen are worth more than the spice. I'm your host, Humphrey Shue, and joining me are my friends and co-hosts, Fillmore John.
What's up, guys?
And Nolan Zhang.
Welcome back, everyone.
Indeed. Welcome back, everyone. Today, we will be covering chapter 39 of Dune fully. So it's a rather short chapter, so we get to do another, you know, full chapter episode. But yeah, so this chapter is also pretty hectic, but really glad to be back here with you guys and discuss it. Yeah. So before we get into that, anything new from y'all that y'all want to talk about, or should we just go straight into the epigraph?
So actually, I made some dumplings this week. Homemade.
Wow. Ooh, okay.
Yeah.
We made some wontons too this week, actually. It's good. Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have that store-bought MSG taste. It just tastes better, I guess.
Yeah, it doesn't.
Or worse, it depends on.
I don't know. It's not overdone with garlic and stuff. Yeah. Yeah.
I think it allows you to customize it. I think that's what makes it the most special.
Yeah, with our wontons, we got to put a lot of different ingredients into the filling. We got to put, you know, meats and also mushrooms and ginger and a lot of other stuff too. I mean, I can't.
A lot healthier.
Green onion and all of that. And it was so good. Yeah, the wontons are so good.
Speaking of this whole like food topic, I actually did quite a bit of chopping, you know, chopping a little shrooms this week because I was preparing some ingredients for the hot pot, and I guess I just learned how to cut those mushrooms. Like, I had to cut like the enoki ones, which were fine, and then there's like the regular ones, like the, I don't know, just like the regular size ones, and then there's like a massive like king size one. What is this? And it's just like interesting seeing how different people cut it and like how the slicing is different for like the sizes.
And sometimes, you know, you chop it up into little squares, but sometimes for like filling, like at least for wonton filling, that's what we were doing. Because, and then sometimes, you know, you gotta slice it into those little pieces,
like the slice, like a little, like it's so like. Mushrooms just come in different shapes and sizes.
indeed. It all tastes good though. Yeah. Right, anyways, very cool. All right, lots of food. I mean, makes me hungry. It's pretty late at night, and I mean, I just had dinner a few hours ago, but I'm still hungry now.
Gotta get a midnight snack.
That'll be fun. Yeah, definitely I'll get one of those. Right, but before we get a midnight snack, we gotta discuss this chapter. So Nolan, why don't you take it away with the epigraph?
Okay, so today's epigraph reads, "Deep in the human unconscious is a pervasive need for a logical universe that makes sense. But the real universe is always one step beyond logic." From the sayings of Muad'Dib by the Princess Irulan. So I was reading it and I was like, wow, this kind of resonates a lot with me, because I feel that when we are exposed to the Dune sci-fi world, we encounter so much new technology and like different concepts that Herbert's trying to paint to us. Especially when it comes to the Fremen, that there are some things that basically is outside of our scope of knowledge or aren't even meant to have a scientific basis sometimes. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it doesn't stop us like three high school STEM center students from trying to explain to, I guess, the audience, y'all, like how every new thing could possibly work. And probably half the time or more, we're probably wrong, but it's just like, I don't know. It's just still fun to do.
Yeah, the speculation part is what keeps us reading, to be honest.
Yeah, there's so much to discover. Yeah,
but like I honestly like feel like we're so guilty of having this pervasive need for a logical universe that this epigraph just makes sense to me. Mm-hmm. And I feel like what Paul is saying about the universe always being one step beyond logic is kind of right, because it's similar to the common saying that like for every new discovery that humans make, there will always be much more questions than answers that we come across. So it's just like we'll never stop having questions about the world.
Yeah.
I mean, it's natural human nature to be curious about everything.
Yeah, it is, and that's what's really driven a lot of, you know, different
inventions and ideas. And,
yeah, so that's, you know, if humans were satisfied, then, you know, we would not progress as a civilization. So it's that endless drive, and that's what, you know, I think it's a really good trait, but also it just, you know, never satisfied, always kind of looking for new things. Yeah, sort of feeling.
Also remember, curiosity kills a cat, and we only have 9 lives.
Oh yeah, we only have 9 lives, right? Yeah.
Right. But fortunately, we aren't cats.
Unfortunately,
or unfortunately, it depends on how you slice the pie. Right. Anyways, so before we get started, let's do our quote section. So as usual, Fillmore, you have the first quote.
Okay, so my quote for this week is, "Nothing is innocent in an emperor's eyes."
Oi, oi, oi.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Emperor seeing things. Anyways, so so my quote goes, it's well known that repression makes a religion flourish.
Pilgrims.
Oh, yeah. Yep. True. I should
take the Mayflower across the Atlantic Ocean.
Yeah, they built a whole ship and took it across the ocean. Yeah.
Okay, so my quote is actually the longest today, and it goes, the recruits come to believe in time that such a place as Seleucia Secundus is justified because it prolonged them, the elite. The commonest Sardaukar troops lives a life, in many respects, as exalted as that of any member of a great house.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so very cool stuff. Very cool quotes. But yeah, let's dive right into the bulk of the chapter. So after the events of last chapter, remember we were talking about the Baron and Fade's, you know, really interesting relationship. That's maybe not so much a good relationship anymore, right? But after the events of last chapter, we get to see our good Mentat Thufir Hirwat again. Wow. So we talked all about him last chapter, but he was sort of behind the scenes. So now we get to see him talking and thinking, and even get to see inside his head from his point of view. So wow, you know, really nice to see. But let's remember last time we saw him was he was with the Fremen for the first time, and he got knocked out by the Sardaukar, right? And so now he's captured and in the custody of the Harkonnens, and he's been their servant for 2 to 3 years now. And that was the time skip between perhaps 3 years. Yeah. And as we sort of expect from Hawat, he has a little bit of sass, actually. So the first words we hear from him are, or not even words, but the first thoughts he has are, I've sat across from many rulers of great houses, but never seen a more gross and dangerous pig than this one. So immediately throwing shade. he's in the shade of the Baron, right? He doesn't have to throw it.
Yeah. Wow.
I mean, his distaste isn't unwarranted because he's been living for over a century. And the fact that this is the ugliest person he's ever seen is saying a lot.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, that's quite the insult. Ouch. And imagine a 100-year-old grandpa coming up to you and saying, you are the ugliest person I've ever seen, you know. Imagine
how in all my 100 years you're the ugliest person I've ever seen.
Yeah, it's a cranky old grandpa.
Yeah, it makes you wonder if a young Baron was quite handsome, though. I really want to know what he looked like before he became bad.
I really don't want to think down that path. Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine. I mean, what's it called? Personality is what's
important. Yeah, personality is what matters. And
the Baron's personality, definitely, he has some things to work on.
I mean, if we're going down that path, then, like, hopefully he was a much younger, better-looking specimen when he made Jessica, you know? But, like, maybe after the whole breakup, I don't know, like, sometimes stress eating is just the way to go.
Yeah. Yeah, he's been very stressed, you know, whenever he's stressed.
It comes out.
It is a psychological condition, but, yeah.
So, now we're here, and Hawal has sat down, and he is kind of hyper analyzing the room that he is in with the Baron, from like the opulence of the table's grains to the red walls of the private conference room and the faint sweet herb scent that's just around him. It kind of reminds me of like my English teacher telling me to find devices within every single thing, including like behind US memorials. Like, I don't know, I guess to help y'all kind of understand a bit, just like take the Vietnam War Memorial in Washington, D.C. She was like, the gradual slope of the memorial is indicative of some profound message.
Okay.
But then, like, we're just like, bro, what? It's like the rest of the class and I were just like, you know, Washington, D.C. is hilly, right? Like, it's probably just a hill. Like, I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah.
It's just like, no. Architects spend so much time thinking about this. I'm like, sure.
They spend so much time figuring out how to fit the memorial up the hill. Yeah, they're thinking sure. About. Yeah, I mean, that's a pretty hilarious story. I mean, but this could also be applied to our show. We're just grasping at straws when Herbert probably wrote some passages with no deeper intention, and we're just breaking it down. And so, anyways,
we're trying to see his foreshadowing, but we're actually just foreshadowing Paul's father.
I don't even know. Yeah.
Anyways, Hawat says that the Baron babbles too much, and Leto and the Old Duke were able to convey sentences with minimal communication. Mm-hmm. So I think this shows the difference between the connection that Hawat feels with his old master and now his new master.
Yeah.
And that it also outlines that he thinks that the Baron is less competent compared to them as well. Because he even thinks that killing the Duke, or not the Duke, the Baron, is for the better of mankind, which I completely agree with.
Yeah. Picking one for the team.
I mean, exactly. Hawaii has stayed true to the Atreides, right? I mean, he's masked his hate for the Harkonnen so well that he's played the Baron.
Congratulations.
You played him. Though. Yeah. I mean, I knew he could do it all along, but you know, it's nice to see that he's done it here. Yeah. We believed in you, Hawaii, and he's executed perfectly.
Mm-hmm. So here we see that actually Hawaii and the Baron are kind of having a bit of a spat, I guess. Mm-hmm. And like Hawaii is telling the Baron and challenging him on his knowledge of the prison planet Seleucia Secundus. And the Baron's quite defensive, defending what he knows about the planet, like how like the true nature of the planet actually is. And the Baron just believes it's just a simple like prison planet for whoever the Emperor doesn't like. And so he just throws them there. But the truth is, Hawaii believes there's so much more to the planet. However, the Baron just, because he believes so strongly in his own assumptions, like these, like we talked about this last chapter as well, how like the Baron believes so strongly in what he believes that he kind of like dismisses everything else. And right now, Hawaii is asking him to like rethink it, right? But he feels so challenged that he's just like constantly resisting the idea that he could have been wrong. And he's just not giving Hawaii a chance right now to really speak his mind freely.
Yeah. I mean, he's a very stubborn monster. If things don't go his way, or if something goes against him, you're dead.
That's true.
He doesn't learn from his mistakes because his god complex makes him think that he doesn't make any. Uh-huh. Instead, he blames others when things go wrong.
Yeah, and also another thing I noticed is that Hawat's not really acting subservient. I expected him to be a little more have a little more deference, right?
Dude, I don't know.
Yeah, but I mean, he's very sassy, as I said. He continues to keep interrupting the Baron. And even the Baron says later, you know, oh, I'll remember how he treated me or something. He's just,
oh, yeah.
It's kind of weird because he's so angry, but he knows he can do nothing about it. Yeah. So he's just sort of petty kind of comment in his head, right? But I mean, the Baron is taking offense, but Hawat is talking to him almost as an equal, right? But I suppose the Baron's reigning in his anger because he values more the insight that Hawat is providing, because Hawat acts almost excited about all this, all the things he's saying, right? He just keeps interrupting and whatever. Yeah.
In a way, like, I don't want to say, like, Hawat is kind of like the fence to fade in this scenario, but Hawat is able to actually interpret his worth to the Baron in the correct, like, mm-hmm. scope, I guess, while Faye just failed to recognize how important he is to the Baron's plan. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
His interactions reminds me of the interactions with Peter as well, because, you know, Peter and the Baron, they were like bantering and whatnot, but like Hawat's, I mean, he's also sassy like Peter.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's what happens when you know how much you're valued.
Okay, so the mortality rate on Seleucia Secundus is over 60%.
Wow.
And that's absolutely absurd.
It is.
Because that means your life is on a coin toss that's slightly more biased to kill you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. I mean, yeah, that's just a really crazy, just imagine flipping those weighted coins and then 60% chance, you know, if you flip it enough times, you know, you'll land on heads.
The house that always wins.
Yeah.
Yep. That means that the mortality rate on Arrakis is even higher than 60 if they produce warriors that are even stronger than the Sardaukar.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you just get wiped out by that sandstorm if you're like left standing outside, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I doubt the mortality rate among the Fremen is over 60%, because I feel like that's a huge figure. Yeah. And I feel that huge figure comes a lot from the Emperor's own hand and torture and just mass murder and stuff like that, right? And I feel like natural causes, it's kind of hard to have such a mortality rate, but however, the Fremen's conditions that they must survive and thrive in seem to be as bad or maybe even worse than the Emperor's near worst planet, his prison planet. Yeah. So that's pretty crazy.
But if they were both on an even field where they were just forced onto a planet, I would say the Fremen planet is worse to live on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like if the Emperor had decided to host his prison planet on Arrakis instead of Seleucia Secundus, I really feel like even the Emperor himself would have had a really hard time setting up the infrastructure for a prison planet on such a barren, remote.
Yeah, it would be at probably 80-70% mortality rate.
Yeah, like the Emperor would probably run out of water to feed all the prisoners and be like, oops, guys, I guess you're all dying today.
Yeah, they would fight over the remaining water and maybe like eat each other. Who knows?
Yeah. So it's anyway, it's terrible conditions, but only these terrible conditions bring these strong warriors. Yeah.
Strong, yeah. Man. That makes me wonder, like, once Arrakis is terraformed into a more livable planet, I wonder, they're not going to be as strong anymore.
Strong is like subjective, but you're right. Like, they wouldn't have the same mindset anymore.
Right. They wouldn't be as tough.
Yeah, so one of the tennis players I watch, like, well, he's the best tennis player in the world, Novak Djokovic, but he a lot of times he credits his mental strength on the tennis court as due to his upbringing in Serbia during the war. So
the Slavic wars, yeah, when it split.
Yeah, something like that. I mean, honestly, I'm not too familiar with that section of history, but it was in the 90s or 80s. The 80s, yeah.
And they killed each other, the neighbors.
Yeah, and then yeah, so he says, you know, kind of that those circumstances cultivated him to be, you know, one of the players with the strongest mental, one of the strongest mental games you've ever seen. And so that's kind of the Fremen. I mean, no matter what, you won't be able to simulate this crazy, this crazy environment with all the desert and the worms and, you know, no water and all that. So, yeah.
Yep.
SAO moment. Just kidding.
Anyway, sorry. So I thought the Sardaukar coming from the infamous prison planet was common knowledge, but it looks like this isn't the case at all. Because the Baron was completely unaware of where the Sardaukar came from and started talking about levies and enlistments.
Yeah.
So I guess the Emperor doesn't want people to know where he gets his warriors, because if they knew that planet, then he doesn't have an army anymore.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I thought it also was common knowledge, though, because, like, we've always known that the Sardaukar came from I don't even remember who brought it up. Do y'all remember who brought it up?
I don't know. They just, like, mentioned that they came from, like, from a prison planet at, like, the beginning of the story.
I think it was always hinted by the Mentats and, like, the upper level, like, imperial people. I think we just kind of took that as, like,
everyone. Yeah, we took it for granted. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Right. Yeah, that's, I mean, it's just something I feel like I've always known. But, I mean, I'm not sure whether something like atomics are still valuable, given, you know, everywhere seems to have shields against them. But definitely the Emperor doesn't want potential enemies digging into the sources of his infamous warriors so other people don't figure out how he could train the Sardaukar to be such a terrifying killing machines, right?
And then try to replicate, like, a similar or, like, harsh environment as well.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah, because it's impossible, though. Though it is impossible to replicate, but we don't know. There might be other planets, especially like Arrakis. Other planets like Sosa Secundus and Arrakis, right?
And they're probably, not gonna lie, they're probably cheaper to buy because they have, like, no worth, or they're just so hard to tame.
Oh, that is true. Yeah, if you were to imagine buying planets. No, did you say that? You know, it's just, yeah, buying a house kind of thing. A whole planet, yeah.
How about this one? Yeah. It's got 10 bedrooms.
Well, maybe 10 to the...
Or like 10 oceans.
10 to the power of 10 bedrooms, more like. Uh-huh. Yeah.
I think it could fit your population. Okay, so I just want to take a moment to really appreciate how Hawat is talking back to the Baron. I know we talked on it a bit earlier, but Hawat really doesn't fear the Baron as much as the other Harkonnens or even Fade Rautha does. So when the Baron tries to deny him from speculating on why the Emperor would have aided the Harkonnens in betraying the Atreides, he responds with what I would best describe, kind of like a smart aleck response. It's like a response that you know is technically right, but because it's so right, it's also why you hate it so much, you know? Hawat was just like, any area is open to my speculation if it does what you've hired me to do. I am a Mentat. You do not withhold information or computation lines from a Mentat. He's just like so right, you know? Like, he's got nothing wrong with that, like, response. And the Baron knows about it. And that's what makes him annoyed as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I mean, to be fair, the Baron folded under the pressure, saying, say what you must, Mentat, and let Hawat say his part.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, the Baron, he's still honestly at this point, it's almost like he relies on Hawat more than Hawat relies on him. I mean, of course Hawat relies on him for his life, but with the dialogue in this chapter, you wouldn't think it. You would think, you know, without the Baron's kind of veiled threats and internal monologue, you know, you wouldn't even know. You would think Hawat's the, you know, really crazy
mastermind
leader out here. Yeah.
It's almost like they're having a staring match and like the Baron just keeps losing.
Indeed. Yeah, it's just the Baron keeps losing and it just keeps, you know, flexing his muscles, but he won't admit that he's just worse at the staring match. Yeah. So one thing we should talk about, and I'm not sure if we ever heard about this, but the Atreides are training a group of Fremen. Did we ever hear about this?
Yes, we did.
When was this? I actually can't remember.
Because in the beginning of the story, they were mentioning how they were going to bring in some of the Fremen to act as soldiers for them.
Oh, yeah. You're right. Yeah.
They were trying to do that. Like, yeah. They were really trying to springboard.
But then the Atreides fell.
Kind of fell. Yeah. So I don't think it was ever made clear the scope of that. Just maybe some hints, because
those at most limited to like one siege, because they haven't really had contact with other
sieges because yet. We just know Idaho was sent with Stilgar, to Stilgar's to siege Tabor, right? Yeah, so yeah, I mean, I just thought it was oddly familiar, but I couldn't really place the exact scenario. But I mean, this definitely intimidates the Baron, right? This whole Fremen thing, because he's baffled, but he's finally beginning to see all the connections between all of these hints Hawat has been dropping at his feet. And definitely, I can't really blame the Baron here, no matter how much I like to blame the Baron, because it's a conclusion I probably wouldn't have reached on my own either, but it makes a ton of sense. So the reason the Emperor turned so quickly on Leto was because he felt a threat to his own sovereignty as Emperor, right? Because, I mean, hindsight is 2020 in this case, but I don't know how I didn't see that. It's really the only reason the Emperor would turn on Leto, I feel like, or is one of the probably the only, in general, you know, the one of the reasons that brings rulers to war is they feel a threat to their own power, and so it's probably, you know, some indirect or direct challenge to the throne that these Fremen posed that elicited such a response from the Imperium, you know, with all the shipping tons and tons of Sardaukar and full support for the Baron, right? 50 years of spice.
After all, like, it wasn't the Emperor definitely didn't do it for the spice money, because like I'm sure the Emperor has his own stock of money even more than the Harkonnen, since he probably taxes them for the spice money in the first place.
True, yeah.
So I feel like unless it was like, and like he wasn't willingly support the Harkonnens like out of pocket, because like everyone, even the great houses in the Lensra, has a bad image of the Harkonnens in the first place before everything started already. So like there's no good benefit unless there was like an imminent danger, like his authority being challenged, you know?
Yeah,
I mean, we've always speculated that the reason why he took up Duke Leto is because of the threat he posed to the Imperium.
Like, but like we thought he was because it was too popular and the Lancer would like.
Well, I mean, I still think that's one of the main reasons. But of course, with popularity comes with power, and where we need some sort of power to back up that popularity. And in this case, he had the Fremen, which he was trying to train, and Idaho and Gurney were training soldiers that were actually quite close in power with the Sardaukar.
Or even better, honestly.
Yeah,
and some were even better. I mean, Pol is stronger than a Sardaukar.
Oh, yeah, by far.
Yeah.
And we know Idaho was taking on multiple Sardaukars.
Yeah, Idaho
was probably killed like 20 before he died.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. So he was...
Idaho was just, unfortunately sliced down in a tight passage, but he took down many in the process.
It was a noble last stand. Yeah,
exactly.
But, I mean, it just goes to show how, with the right training, these Sardaukar are just stormtroopers. I
mean, they can't hit their shots.
Yeah, not at all. They just were standing there, you know, waiting to be wiped out. Yeah.
Yeah, so. Lightsabers. Mm-hmm. Okay. One thing that I am astounded, however, is that the Harkonnens have lost over 30,000 plus men just in the past 2 years hunting down the Fremen under Beast Rabban. So, take into account, this is like after the Harkonnen success over the Atreides on Arrakis, and after the Sardaukar have come in, had a little fun hunting the Fremen in the desert for recreational sport or something like that. Mm-hmm. So, like, they've already had a lot of help in wiping out a lot of the Fremen population, at least nearby, and they still lost 30,000 plus men in the process.
Ooh, yeah.
I know. So, like, if the Baron truly believes that his own legions even stand a single chance against the Sardaukar, now, like, this casualty report is nothing to scoff at. In fact, it's beyond worrying, even detrimental. Mm-hmm. Because, like, I know he's just like, oh, like, what if it's like a storm? You know, like, you know, the sandstorms are pretty rough, but if the Fremen can live out there, your soldiers better adapt too. And, like, that's no excuse to losing 30,000 men, because that's embarrassing, just to a sandstorm. Mm-hmm. Like, the KD ratio of the Harkonnens versus the Fremen really are skewed quite heavily against them. So massive negative KD ratio.
Yeah. I mean, the Sardaukar were also being lost at a 5-to-1 ratio, right? So let's just take a moment to remember how those Fremen, you know, all those chapters ago, materialized out of the desert, just whipped up the Sardaukar in a frenzy, destroyed them, took their thopter, and then proceeded to kamikaze bomb a bunch more Sardaukar, right? So that so that was just an epic, and it felt like it happened so fast too. Yeah, so,
They just take out the Sardaukar, take their thopter, took out more Sardaukar, refused to elaborate, and just disappeared.
Yeah. And another guy was like, very efficient. That only costed one man. I was like, oh.
Yeah, very efficient indeed. It's just that it's their value of life. I mean, they're willing to trade it, but at least it's always for a cause. The Baron just wastes life. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's sort of unfortunate, though, that the Fremen Third is actually being recognized now. Because having more time to prepare would be better for them. But I hope 2 years was enough for Paul to train the Fremen in his weirding ways and how to bypass the shields easier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I also hope that Paul was able to not just only like have some sway in Stilgar siege, but I hope he also reached out to other sieges and is able to actually like hold like a, I don't know, like some type of council between multiple sieges. So like he's actually has more Fremen population than just like, I don't know, like 20,000 people in the siege that we saw.
Uh-huh. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we also just kind of see that like Hawat just overall how he discussed the estimation of Fremen population size of being at 5 to 10 millions, because like 250 sieges that Idaho reported times two, because you know he probably didn't meet all that many, like not accounting for like the birth rate growth figure and like the weeding of their less successful specimens. It just gives off like a whole like human science major vibe, kind of like Hawat is really smart. Like he's not just smart in military or like administrator or like just like tactics. He's also really smart in like, I guess just like guessing the population, just analyzing how many people there could be. It reminds me of a lot like when I took AP Human Geography and we had to study like countries' populations, and we analyzed the population pyramids to make assumptions about the country's like future policies and priorities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, as a mentat, Hawat's bound to be good at this calculation math stuff, right? Especially with these estimations. And I mean, he knows all the population patterns, although he knows little about how the Fremen actually managed to make ends meet in this hostile environment. He should have a good gauge on probably, I mean, at least a good lower bound maybe on how many Fremen there are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the population estimate is much greater than what the Baron was originally thinking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. By far.
Not in the millions for sure.
Uh-huh. Right. And let me do some quick calculations of my own. So let's just say that 10% of that 5 million or 10 million was a warrior. That means that the Fremen have a force of 500,000 to 1 million warriors. Ooh. That are the strongest fighters in the verse. Mm-hmm. That's a force to be reckoned with.
Yeah,
and we know that number is a lot higher than that, because there were.
Yeah, it can definitely be a lot higher than that. Yeah,
yeah, because especially you know we're only assuming 10%. The Fremen seem to be a warrior society,
right?
Yeah.
So now it actually comes to my quote, which says the recruits come to believe in time that such a place as Seleucia Secundus is justified because it produced them, the elite. The commonest Sardaukar troopers lives a life in many respects as exalted as that of any member of a great house. So this quote is talking about just the Emperor's prison planet and how Hawat is explaining to the Baron why these like prisoners who just got oppressed under like horrible torture will suddenly believe and like serve the Emperor with so much zeal and like die for the Emperor. So it really reminds me of like this Netflix series that I've been kind of watching this break called The 3%. And it's just like the premise of the series that there's the inland where 97% of the population live and conditions are terrible. Now there's like the offshore as like a luxurious island where everyone's needs are taken care of, but only 3% are qualified to enjoy the benefits. And how it's like decided who the 3% are is this selective trials and tests called the process that supposedly selects humanity's finest and most deserving people. And there's like this whole idea of like Herbert right now that's painting it as like this, the whole like the Seleucia Secundus concept kind of reminds me of that, because like only a certain amount of prisoners survive the training to become a Sardaukar, and the Emperor is sure to reward them with a life of luxury to the point where like they could belong to like a member of the house of like a great house and just like live the same life as them. Mm. Honestly, Herbert paints it like Herbert's painting of human nature is quite like pessimistic almost. It's like attack on how easy humans are to be bought by a system that allows the majority to suffer, while the minority lives in extravagant wealth under this paper thin justification that minority is truly above the majority if rather made it that far. Mm-hmm. Though the thing is, like, I am being kind of harshly critical here, because the truth is it's an easy mindset to fall into if like we forget to be compassionate and find like a positive aspect in every single person. It's kind of like easy to dismiss like other people's struggles, especially after we've succeeded where they are currently failing. And by dismissing them, we take away chances that they have at help, which honestly one might have received in their own journey to the top, or at the very minimum would have loved to have received during their own misery.
Mm-hmm. Right. Wow. I mean, that Netflix series sounds really cool. I feel like there's a lot of dystopias where somehow the worthy are selected through questionable means. You know, sometimes it's
Like the crazy test.
Yeah, maybe the Hunger Games or some crazy, you know, test or some form of hazing or something like that. Right?
Yeah.
But I mean, the Sardaukar in this case are basically brainwashed because they really believe that ordeals such as that terrible prisoner planet, Seleucus Secundus, is a good scheme to weed out the weak and, you know, also sort of weed out the strong to be able to kind of see who is separate the two, right?
It's like a game almost. Like, oh, by the way, you finally unlocked the final chapter.
Yeah, and I mean, yeah, these Seleucus Secundus Sardaukar, I mean, they're definitely the strongest, because they wouldn't have become such a crazy, you know, strong fighting force otherwise, right? So they must have come through a lot of struggle and propaganda to become as exalted as Great House members, right? They're treated with lots of respect and royalty almost. And I mean, the Fremen culture is much more dignified, in my opinion, than the Sardaukar. And although the Fremen are kind of weird and different, I feel like
they have moral values.
Yeah, like, but they have more values. Yeah, they have more value. Yeah,
especially because they have to worry about water all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
yeah, and they definitely have values. You know, even with Jamis, remember when Jamis, mm-hmm. that person who said I was a friend of Jamis because I ran out of water and Jamis helped me gave me, and you know, so that's one of the examples. And they're definitely a more tight sense of community, even though they seem to be a little bit fanatic, right? But
a bit eccentric.
Yeah. And how, like, their culture is more dignified and they produce better warriors. So, I mean, the Emperor definitely has something to pick up here, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, but on the other hand, I think this feeding into their ego that they're the strongest is what's causing them to underestimate the Fremen. Because now that Paul has joined the ranks of them, the 5-to-1 ratio may even double to 10-to-1.
Just with the training that he's giving them.
Exactly. I mean, I usually don't like conflict, but I'm itching to see one to see how much the Fremen improved.
Yeah, like, I'm actually just waiting to see like that same scene, except hopefully no Fremen die this time.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a bloodbath.
Yeah, It will be.
Okay, so now we get to my quote for this week, which is, "Nothing is innocent in an emperor's eyes." Mm-hmm. So this quote is quite short, but it shows how power hungry and paranoid the Emperor is. Because I bet that if you built a self-defense force so that you don't get invaded, the Emperor would see that as a threat and he would send a Sardaukar. Because that's basically what the Atreides did. They were making strong soldiers in order to protect themselves from
The Harkonnens.
Yeah, from the Harkonnens. But the Emperor saw that as a threat and they got wiped out. So in a strange, twisted way, some of the Baron's qualities can be found within the Emperor. Mm-hmm. The greed to stay in power is ever so prominent.
Right.
Yes, the face of Leto, but the ambitions of the Baron.
Yeah, there's a lot more, you know, in common between the Emperor and the Baron than the Emperor and Leto, I'm sorry to say.
Apple doesn't fall far from the tree.
Indeed. but although, you know, even though they're cousins, right, or something, Leto and the Emperor, I mean, the Emperor has, you know, joined the dark side.
Yeah. Dun, dun, dun.
Oh no. A cappella group. That's us.
So one thing that I am not quite sure is why Hawa is so upset when he figures out that the Emperor, Count Fremen may have been tipped off by the Baron when he told him of like the plans to replicate Arrakis, because he was inspired by the Emperor's prison planet. So he's like, he was so upset that he cursed, you know, and then when he learned that the Baron had told Count Fremen all these things. Because the thing is, like, I kind of assumed that like Hawat isn't actually working for the Harkonnens full-heartedly, at least, and therefore wouldn't support the Harkonnens gaining access to these overpowered legions of Fremen fighters that he is, you know, leaking away all the information of to the Baron. However, like, if he is working for the Pride of the Atreides, now, why would he reveal in the first place, like, so urgently, in fact, to tell the Baron of the potential gold mine of value that he's sitting on right now? Mm-hmm. So, like, he's kind of just encouraging the Baron to use Raban's oppression to kind of fulfill the creation of a planet with the most extreme conditions. So, like, why would he do that? I don't understand.
Yeah, these are all good questions that I believe Herbert will answer in time. Because Hawat hasn't shown the readers his full hand yet. Just as the Baron asks later, how does Hawat's plans fit in all of this? I mean, we don't know, and he doesn't know. And Hawat doesn't really give any hints, you know, even though we know his, we hear his internal monologue a bit, we don't really get any hints. But likely it'll be a Herbert special. You know, we're not going to get the whole Hawat, you know, in this case, it wouldn't be a villain internal monologue, but you know, all those times where the villain talks all about her plans and then tries to execute them and they all go wrong. So, I mean, instead of Hawat internal monologuing his plans to the reader, we'll probably just get the action. Yeah, I think it'll be a Herbert special.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really want to see how this will play out, especially because Hawat currently thinks he has nothing to lose.
Let's see
the full potential of a Mentat who's lived over a century.
Definitely. I'm very excited to see that. There's so many people, you know, who just, a lot of it is just bottled up pressure so far. And yeah, we'd like to see how.
Waiting for the
boom. Yeah.
Yeah, the only person we've seen the full power of is probably Duncan, to be honest.
Oh yeah, Duncan with the when he tried to fight the Sarukar, he was just cutting him down.
And also, that was actually quite impressive.
Yeah, and also we saw the Fremen go off on the Sarukar, although we don't know if that was full power or not.
Probably not.
Yeah. I feel like we haven't tapped into the full potential because there was no sandworms in play.
they could literally ride in with the hook and. Yeah, oh my gosh.
I want to see how that plays in a battle.
Yeah, I want to see someone like Paul use a hook sometime. You know,
riding a sandworm into battle.
Maybe a Bene Gesserit, especially because they have so much balance and poise and stuff, you know.
Yeah.
They'd be the best, you know, maker hookers than anyone. Yeah.
Sandworm surfing.
Indeed. Yeah. Subway surfers, but on steroids. Yeah. Anyways. So Hawat's just kind of echoing Fade and the Baron. So he wants the Baron to keep his own hands clean. And to do this, he's planning to cut off aid to Raban so that Raban drives his people more to meet the spice quotas, and therefore he frees the Baron of any other potential accusations. So it's kind of a sly plan, you know, just make the Baron seem like he's a mercenary, but at least you're not, you know, you might be morally wrong, but you're not committing a crime if you're a mercenary.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, it even coincided with the Baron's plan of putting Fade on the throne, so it's kind of amazing how it all worked out.
Yeah.
Just ties everything together, you know?
Yeah.
So right now, after the full reveal of Hawat's just master realization and plans to counter the Imperium's fear, the Baron also coming to realization that Hawat under his watch had like revealed the secret of the Fremen planet, the Baron's attitude towards Hawat kind of shifts in this late chapter area. So he begins taking on a tone of admiration for Hawat's fantastic assessment abilities and how devious and scheming Hawat really is. And like, to the point that he's so comfortable that he shares his own initial plan, kind of similar to Hawat's plan, but like lacking the full potential. Just like replacing Beast Raban with his chosen heir of Fade Rautha in order to cement Harkonnen control over Arrakis in the long term.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like with Hawat's input, though, his plan of kicking Raban out is becoming far more defined. Like before, he was just thinking about it before, but now he actually has like the actual steps of achieving this instead of just like an outline of what he's going to do.
Plus, he's able to like now like bring in the Fremen army. Like he's gonna able to, he's maximizing how much is able to like come out of this process.
Right, there's actual math behind all his actions now,
not just a little thought.
Yeah, my guy's doing quick maths.
2 + 2 = 4 - 1.
That's 3.
Yeah, math competition.
Yeah, I mean, we're math people. What can we say?
Okay, so then all this internal monologue from Hawat also reveals a juicy piece of information. So he reveals that he is still in contact with Gurney Halleck, actually knows where he is. He's with the smugglers now. And Gurney Halleck is actually relaying information on the current situation on Iraq, especially the current Fremen situation, which is where a lot of the whole reports on the Fremen battle tactics and like Fremen sieges really comes from. But when, especially when you heard about how the Fremen fight nowadays, kind of seeds of doubt are being sown among like his mind about like the true erasure of the whole Atreides household. Because he noticed that a lot of the battle tactics being discussed that the Fremen use seem to only resemble much of Halleck's own tactics, also some of Idaho's tactics, and even some of his own tactics and philosophy. Mm. So he's just like, wow, like who is teaching them this? And he was like, is it actually because Idaho's alive still? Oh. Yeah, but he doesn't know the truth.
Yeah, he sees a little bit of himself there, right? But I mean, it's interesting how Halleck is contacting Hawaz, something you brought up, right? Because doesn't Halleck know that he's talking to someone on Geti Prime under the captivity of their hated Baron? I mean, I don't know. Maybe his messages are being rerouted or something. Because if
how secure is it?
Yeah, how secure is it? Doesn't he know that his messages will get tapped or something? I mean, I'm sure Halleck doesn't want to give any information to the Baron, right? But as I interpreted, like Paul and Jessica are the ones behind all these new battle plans, right? Because they offer to teach the weirding way of battles. So it's cool to see the blending of these two great entities. They're so great. And the Atreides and the Fremen, you know, they're so powerful. At least the Atreides were really powerful and the Fremen still are very powerful. And I'm excited to see what they can create from this fusion of ideas. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Oh, for some reason, I thought when I was reading this, I missed the part where Halleck was in contact with them, with the smugglers, actually.
Oh.
So I thought he was just talking to the talking about Halleck's reports before the Atreides fell apart.
Oh, okay. Yeah, we always forget Halleck's with the smugglers because we haven't when was that? That was towards the beginning of book two, I feel like.
Yeah, it was a long time ago.
That was before Jessica and Paul were, you know, put on that thopter, right? Or around the time they were put on that thopter and like, you know,
it was just a brief mention of what like Halleck was doing with his men and like how the Fremen saved them. And well, not the Fremen. No, the Fremen left them, I think. And then they found a place among the smugglers and the smugglers offered them some way off the planet, but they were stuck with the spice anyway. So it's too late. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So my quote for the week was, it's well known that repression makes a religion flourish. So, I mean, this quote holds really true. Of course, Nolan, at the beginning of the episode, you brought up the Puritans, right? And also in biblical times, Christianity was oppressed, but then it was flourished, mm-hmm. right? Because they crucified Jesus, right? But then, you know, the religion ended up flourishing. Of course, it's one of the largest religions today. And in slavery, you know, in the 1800s, I mean, the religion wasn't directly oppressed. Yeah, sometimes even the slave owners encouraged it because it would lessen the chance of revolt. But it like still Christianity flourished in that time and the people were still being oppressed, right? And oppressed people tend to look out for things in this world. Well, tend to look out of this world for things, you know, that's not in this world, and they want to look forward to things that that aren't in this painful world that they live in, right? And they want
to find an escape from their painful present.
Right. Right, yeah, and they want to have hope, and it's interesting though how the religion of in the book here with the Muad'Dib, how this religion is flourishing not only among the Fremen but also among the peasantry of Arrakis, you know, the like the Graben Sinkempan people, and so Paul's reach is far. It doesn't just extend within his siege or, you know, within the Fremen; it even goes out to the peasantry. And and we don't know if this already tips the scales in the favor of the jihad, but it could, right? However, it would be a scary sight indeed if the Fremen rise up behind Paul. Of course, that's the first thing of the jihad, right? But that'll set the old Baron really quaking in his boots because the Fremen are a very intimidating fighting force.
Yeah, I mean, I can sort of. You can go ahead.
Okay, so like, I just want to note something. So I remember last chapter, the Baron kind of also dismissed the religion as just like some little mouse thing. Mm-hmm. Kind of like Hawat does something similar here, where it's just like, oh, I should have probably looked into a religion more, but like I got more important things on my hand, or like, it's probably not that important, you know? So like he also dismisses the idea of the Muad'Dib religion. But I'm just like wondering if the potential of what would have happened if he had just looked further into it, like if he had researched more and found Paul at the center of it, would he have swapped allegiances then? I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Not sure. Yeah. But we end off the chapter on a low note. Jessica is still suspected by Hawat. He hasn't given up his old suspicions. And I'm sure there's no reason that he'd suspect otherwise, since he'd been fed false information. And wasn't it the Baron himself who said, you know, feed a man to have false information and false calculations come out or something like that? And I want, but I mean, we know that this is false, but I wonder if this is a hint at Jessica's actions in the future. I mean, given Herbert decided to bring it up here, maybe, you know, some of Jessica's actions do, you know, bring down the Atreides even further. We don't know, but I mean, I'm sure it won't be intentional though.
You guys have any guesses as to what will happen when Hawat sees Jessica?
Definitely we're gonna see that 1v1 again, but hopefully Hawat has the upper hand this time.
I mean
he has prep time this time.
Yeah, but we don't know if well, of course Hawat's personality changes and stuff, so the voice doesn't work as well, I feel, because Jessica's no longer as familiar with Hawat.
Yeah, he
needs to register. Well, I mean, she did also unlock the powers of the Reverend Mother, so that's true. I guess we'll see.
Right.
All the years of experience of sitting people down.
It's another major 1v1 we'll get to look forward to. Although, you know, it's more likely, since they are protagonists, it's more likely to just sit down, have a cup of tea, you know, talk over their grievances, and that's about it, right? If only all...
I mean, I feel like Paul would play a part. He would be like, Jessica is innocent or something, and then Hawat would understand.
If only all, you know, conflicts are settled like that over a cup of tea. Not crazy war, which is what we're getting in book and what we're getting in real life. Right. But so on that note, I believe that concludes the discussion for this episode of the Do Not Enter podcast. Make sure to read halfway through chapter 40, ending at the words, "Rode like a reverend mother or one of the sick and wounded." And tune in next time when we discuss it. As always, thanks to all of you listeners for being patient with us and being interested in our thoughts. Follow us on Instagram at DoNotEnter, Reddit @U/DoNotEnter, Twitter at DoNotEnter, and email us at DoNotEnter@gmail.com. That is DoNotEnter@gmail.com. Please contact us with questions, feedback, or...
I think it's my turn this time.
Yeah.
Or I dare say, Urkershins.
Urkershins, okay. All right,
percussion.
Yeah, we get more instruments as us musicians. Yeah, like last episode we had the accordion, now it's the percussion. Cool. Anyway, musical instruments are better than mistakes, right? Well, we make a lot of mistakes playing musical instruments, but still.
Fair.
But of course, if we've made any mistakes, don't hesitate, and unlike a live performance, we'll correct them in the next episode. Right? We have more chances here. Please give us a review on iTunes or Spotify. It only takes a few seconds of your time. Of course, you have to go make an account. But after that, you know, you can just go to our show, click the 5-star button because it's the only one that exists, and leave a nice comment or two if you're so inclined. The reasons for this are twofold. One, it helps get our podcast up the charts so that we can get our show to a wider variety of listeners and bring Dune to a larger audience. And two, on a personal note, it really motivates us to keep creating content for you guys and lets us know that we're doing a good job. So we really appreciate if you took the time to do that. Otherwise, have a great week, and we will see you all back very soon.
See you guys.
Bye, guys.